Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome back to Vashon 250, Episode 23. Today, we're looking at Nathan Hale, a American patriot, soldier, and spy for the Continental Army during the American Revolutionary War. A graduate of Yale, he volunteered for an intelligence gathering in New York City, but was captured by the British and executed. Hale is considered an American hero. And for today's presentation, we have our good friend Nancy Bristow back. So Nancy, tell us more about him.
After the Revolutionary War began in 1775, Hale joined a Connecticut militia union and was elected first lieutenant within 5 months. His company participated in the siege of Boston, but Hale remained behind. It's been suggested that he was unsure as to whether he wanted to fight or possibly that he was hindered because his teaching contract in New London, Connecticut, continued. On July 4, 1775, Hale received a letter from his classmate and friend, Benjamin Talmadge, who had gone to Boston to see the siege for himself. He wrote to Hale, quote, "Was I in your condition, I think the more extensive service would be my choice. Our holy religion, the honor of our God, a glorious country and a happy constitution is what we have to defend," end quote. Talmadge's letter was so inspiring that, several days later, Hale accepted a commission as first lieutenant in the 7th Connecticut Regiment under Colonel Charles Webb of Stamford.
Nancy, that's a fascinating sort of combination of patriotism and religion. And you begin to see that throughout American history. And we'll come back and deal with that more. But, you know, that's about as blatantly, you know, tying the two together as you can get.
Absolutely.
So Hale was also a member of Nelson's Rangers, the first organized intelligence service of the United States of America, led by Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Nelson. In the spring of 1776, the Continental Army moved to Manhattan to defend New York City against the anticipated British attack. In August, the British soundly defeated the Continentals. George Washington was desperate to determine the location of the imminent British invasion of Manhattan and called for a spy behind enemy lines. Hale was the only volunteer. On September 8, 1776, Hale volunteered to go behind enemy lines and report on British troop movements, which he knew was an act of spying punishable by death. On September 12th, he was ferried across Long Island Sound to Huntington, New York, on British-controlled Long Island. Hale planned to disguise himself as a Dutch schoolteacher looking for work, although he did not travel under an assumed name and reportedly carried with him his Yale diploma bearing his name. Sort of the, sounds like some of our CIA agents yes. at times, right?
And it won't go well. While Hale was undercover, New York City, then an area at the southern tip of Manhattan, fell to British forces on September 15th. So Washington was forced to retreat to the north in Harlem Heights. On September 21st, a quarter of the lower portion of Manhattan burned in the Great New York Fire of 1776. The fire was later widely thought to have been started by American saboteurs in order to keep the city from falling into British hands. And though setting fire to New York during Washington's retreat had indeed been proposed, Washington and Congress had rejected the idea and denied responsibility. The Americans accused British soldiers of starting the fires without orders from their superiors so they could sack the city. In an account of Hale's capture, Major Robert Rogers of the Queen's Rangers saw Hale in a tavern and recognized him. After luring Hale into betraying his allegiance by pretending to be a patriot himself, Rogers and his Rangers apprehended Hale near Flushing Bay in Queens, New York. British General William Howe reportedly questioned Hale, and physical evidence was found on him. Rogers provided information about the case.
According to the standards of the time, spies were hanged as illegal combatants. By all accounts, Hale comported himself well before the hanging,
Frederick Mackenzie, a British officer, wrote this diary entry for the day. He behaved with great composure and resolution, saying he thought it the duty of every good officer to obey any orders given him by his commander in chief, and desired the spectators to be at all times prepared to meet death in whatever shape it might appear. On the morning of September 22nd, 1776, Hale was hanged. He was 21 years old. No official records were kept of Hale's final speech. It has traditionally been reported that his last words, either entirely or in part, were, "I only have regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." So as we look at U.S. history after that, there are two aspects to the Nathan Hale story. Patriotism, his willingness to give his life for his country, unprepared, not trained or prepared for being a spy. So folks, what are some of the instances over the last 250 years of American history that reflect changing attitudes and definitions of patriotism?
Well, in part, the very concept of patriotism is not strong, particularly in the late, 18th century. It develops, and it develops as America develops as a nation, and it particularly begins to develop as America begins to enter wars, Barbary Wars, and then the War of 1812, where it becomes important to define what it means to be an American, but also around the emergence of the Star-Spangled Banner, the sort of American flag, originally with 13 stars, and then adding stars as new states are added. And so during the War of 1812, when the Star-Spangled Banner poem, which becomes our national anthem, is written, you begin to get this sense of nationalism beginning to emerge. Particularly in the 1830s and 1840s, as America is expanding westward, you begin to get this concept of manifest destiny, this Western expansion. And manifest destiny is essentially this concept of, it's our God-given right and our God-given duty to expand the American empire westward, to take over the continent, from sea to shining sea, as the song goes, begins to become this sort of central concept of what it means to be an American.
And it's so powerful, right? Because it has that religious connotation, and it also has a sort of civil religion connotation. So to be an American, to be a patriot, is to do what God has asked us, to defend what is this God-given right as a nation to expand coast to coast, as the idea of manifest destiny suggests. That, of course, will take us into the war with Mexico, which we'll talk more about in a bit, but very much defined by the idea that we have not only the right, but the responsibility to fulfill this charge from God as an exceptional nation advancing civilization.
Yeah, and as part of that is the concept of the sort of removal and destruction of the native savages. This concept of these unchristian, savage people who inhabit the continent, who are there to be pushed aside, to be eliminated. And it becomes a sort of motivation for the Indian Wars that begin in the 1830s and 40s, the Trail of Tears in the Carolinas, just basically displacing people and moving them further westward. And then, with the subsequent Indian Wars, particularly after the Civil War, the Great Plains Wars that go on into the early 20th century.
And of course, we can't skip over the Civil War, which is a defining moment in all of this. When the Confederate states determine that they are interested in leaving the Union because they want to maintain the institution of slavery and its expansion, the determination is by the remaining Union states that you cannot do that, that it is a union in perpetuity, and that the United States, those two terms are both very important. We are a united set of states, not individual states. And so, of course, this becomes a hugely contested notion with the South later wanting to declare that it was, in fact, defending Americanism by way of defending states' rights, when in reality they left the Union with the intention of becoming a separate Union, a Confederacy, of separate states. What's really interesting for me is the ways in which the United States will transition from this domestic, this internal looking, where we are both fighting the Indian Wars on the one hand, laying stake to the entire continental United States as we know them today. But then increasingly, as we become more powerful, we turn that idea of patriotism internationally as well. So there's a pretty long, you know, quiet phase in international relations in terms of defending our patriotism abroad by serving in these international wars. But we get back to it as we turn towards the end of the 19th and then into the 20th century with big stick diplomacy. And you've got Teddy Roosevelt declaring the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine that says, Monroe says we will not have European intervention in the Western Hemisphere. Roosevelt says we can be the police power for the entire hemisphere. Not only do we keep other people out, but we're now kind of going to oversee the entire hemisphere. And that kind of jingoistic approach to international affairs is made possible in part by the remarkable American success in the Spanish-American War in 1898. Here we are, this small, relatively new nation that takes care of the Spanish Empire with very little trouble, much to the surprise not only of Spain, but certainly the Americans as well, and become then the inheritor of colonies, Guam, Puerto Rico, and ultimately we'll choose to annex the Philippines as well in the most troubling aspect of that post-war.
And that's a, you know, so you bring up a fascinating point. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, in the 1780s, 1790s, you know, America's fighting a revolution against an empire, you know, and for 100 years, we're internally focused, if you will, and we sort of end up conquering a continent for a large part and become what we consider, you know, the United States, at least the continental United States. You know, Alaska and Hawaii are kind of stuck out there on the edges. But by the end of that century, we're reestablishing ourselves as a new British Empire. And in the 20th century, just as the 19th century is the British century, the 20th century becomes the American century, which raises the question, is the 21st century going to be the Chinese century?
And one, I guess, has to wait to see for sure. But I think that's a really important way to frame that transition as the United States becomes really a world player. If we announce ourselves with the Spanish-American War and the creation of these colonies or the taking over of these nations, and I'm glad you mentioned Hawaii and all of that, in turn, we will now see ourselves as promoting democracy abroad. So nothing we do is wrong. It's understood to be patriotic to share the, quote, American way with the rest of the world. So in World War I, Wilson will talk about dedicating ourselves, our lives, and our fortunes in order to make the world safe for democracy. But we're doing that alongside, right, invading countries all through Central America and the Caribbean, because under the Roosevelt corollary, we've determined that we have the right to maintain some sort of, quote, stability, end quote, in the hemisphere. And that's a really different stance in the world than we'd seen previously, and a different conceptualization of who we are as a country, it seems to me. So that the 20th century really is distinctive from what had come before.
Yeah. And sort of a lot of people don't realize that the Americans actually send troops into Russia during the Russian Revolution to fight on the side of the white Russians against the red Russians. And so, you know, this is the 19-teens when the United States is just sort of getting its legs as an international power. And it sets up our interventionist sort of policies for the rest of the 20th century.
Exactly. And alongside that, of course, Bruce, the United States will also become much more preoccupied with people establishing their own patriotism internally, right? And so during the war, for instance, it's a war to make the world safe for democracy, and Congress passes and the president signs two of the most extraordinarily repressive impositions on free speech with the Espionage and Sedition Act. So that during the war, it is literally illegal to cast aspersions on the flag, the Constitution, the uniform of the military. And many people go to prison over this. There's more than 2,000 cases and more than 1,000 people see the inside of prison cells. And then in the 1920s, of course, this doesn't cease and desist, but in fact gets worse. Yeah. Following the war, you have the Red Scare, where again, we are imprisoning people as well as deporting people, often with very limited evidence. again, something that is unfortunately little familiar to us today. And this is connected to that Bolshevik revolution and the increasing fear that communism poses some sort of existential threat to the United States. So you'll have the Red Scare, you'll have really harsh repression of the striking laborers in the 19-teens and 20s. And you'll have the immigration restriction, right?
Right. Yep. Yeah. I mean, America, with the Immigration Act of 1920, slams the door shut on 120 years of what made America America. And so it's really this time of contentious sort of what is America going to be? We take a break here. Yeah, let's just take a break. And
one other thing to be said about the immigration restriction in the 1920s is the ways in which it really is tied in with a growing sense that there was something about the United States that was being lost with the new immigrants. By new, Americans at the time simply meant people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, people of darker skin tones often, people who were Catholic and who were Jewish. And so in the permanent legislation that they passed in 1924, they actually reach back not to the most recent census, as the Emergency Act of 1921 had done, but instead they reach back to 1890, before the, quote, new immigration that brought millions and millions of Americans to our shores. And in doing so, they were asserting a kind of white identity to the American patriot. And of course, alongside this at the same moment, we have the rise of the second American Ku Klux Klan reaches its height of popularity, not only in the South, but in the North as well. Remember, the governor of Oregon in the 1920s was himself a Klan member. So we see this contest over the nature of what it means to be an American. If initially it had been proven in the Barbary Wars by signing up to fight the war, now it's done by who are you? Who were your parents? Where do you live? What do you do for work? What churches do you attend? Issues around identity. And those contests, of course, continue right up to the present.
Yeah, and that's what's fascinating to me is about how that blends into what we call the America First Movement in the 1930s that begins to become a much stronger element, kind of an isolationist America First, you know, sort of let's deal with our own problems rather than the world's problems. And, of course, that's, you know, World War II sort of sticks its head into that, and we have to deal with the world's problems. And we emerge out of World War II. With the United Nations, with NATO, with CETO, with CENTO, with a whole set of treaties, you know, designed to position the United States as sort of the policeman of the world, or at least, you know, a major sort of keeper of peace in the world. But that also evokes a kind of strong anti-communism. You know, the Cold War emerges out of that. The McCarthy era emerges out of that. The whole concept of HUAC, the House Un-Americans Activity Committee, emerges out of that. All sort of the sense of what does it mean to be American? What does it mean to be loyal to the United States of America? And then we roll into the Vietnam War, and we get this America love it or leave it kind of attitude, you know, that you can't question the government, even though the Pentagon Papers sort of blow that wide open, you know, and just sort of the government has openly lied to us about the Vietnam War. And then we roll into 9/11, and all of a sudden freedom fries in the sense that, you know, you got to be, you know, true to America. And it sets us up for what we see in the current era with the Trump MAGA organization, sort of looking at what is a true America, make America great again. Well, when was America great? And it opens up that whole set of questions of what it means to be an American and what it means to be loyal and what patriotism is. And, you know, at the same time, you know, Nathan Hale, you know, is sort of a symbol of all that, but he's also a symbol of sort of blatant unpreparedness. I mean, they sent this 21-year-old guy who had no idea what he was doing. And they sent him into the British lines, where he's immediately captured and immediately executed, and makes his famous statement, "But I regret that I only have one life to live for my country." But, you know, you see that in almost every American war. And it's not a criticism of America or American military. It's the very nature of warfare. militaries are preparing for the last war they fought. And so every war we confront, we're confronting new technologies, we're confronting new situations, and we're trying to deal with them. So when you look at the Civil War, you know, the Civil War was sort of, people were thinking of the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, but all of a sudden you have Gatling guns, you have exploding cannonballs, you have the kinds of things that weren't available, you know, 50 years or 100 years prior to that.
And the other thing that's really interesting alongside the sort of technological warfare elements of unpreparedness, there's also the consequences for which we are repeatedly unprepared. So the Mexican-American War brings us all of this new territory that very much feeds right into the Civil War, as we have to fight over whether or not slavery will be allowed to expand into that territory. With the Civil War, we do not have a well-established plan at the end of the war. And again, the contest of the years of Reconstruction is about what happens for 4 million freed people. What will the nature of freedom be? And what consequences should those Confederates, you know, those states that had left in the Confederacy, what consequences should they have to pay? Or the Spanish-American War. Again, we weren't prepared to suddenly be a colonial power, but we were. And we chose, in fact, to go to war against a revolution in the Philippines for 3 years in a horribly bloody and ugly war that in some ways mimicked the very sort of position, the opposite position of, that we had had back in the revolutionary era ourselves.
In which also echo what we would see, you know, 60 years later in Vietnam, you know, so that kind of America becomes the Britain of the 20th century. We're the anti-revolutionaries, whereas in reality, we are the revolutionary country. I mean, it's a conundrum for America to deal with and to define who we are going to be. What does it mean to be an American? How do you prepare for these future wars that are coming along? And so, you know, it's sort of, you look at things like World War II and Pearl Harbor, you know, totally unprepared for it. And 9/11, I mean, there's fascinating sort of studies looking back at the intelligence leading up to all of those kinds of things. And it's very clear that, you know, there was lots of evidence that Pearl Harbor was going to happen. There was lots of evidence that 9/11 was going to happen. There was lots of evidence that the United States would lose in Vietnam. You know, every war game that they'd fought, you know, America lost. And so you have to ask yourself, how do you get a nation to be prepared for what's really unpreparable?
And with that, I would suggest that anybody who runs for president should be listening to this show so that they are prepared. So let's look ahead. We live in conflicted times right now, and we've talked about that before. What are some of the most significant issues that you two see in the U.S. during the past 5 or 6 years that are testing our concepts of patriotism and preparedness?
Well, I think for me, and Nancy, jump in here, of course, you know, the whole concept of immigration, you know, and that's, we talked earlier about the immigration restrictions of the 1920s and sort of slamming at the door on the growth that sort of allowed America to become this preeminent world power. And yet that sort of slamming the door, there's lots of cracks in that door. And the cracks in the door have continued, particularly in the post-war era. With selective immigration, bringing in the best and the brightest, if you will, but also sort of looking the other way with the immigration of labor to do basic fundamental sort of work in the United States. And today, we've got an administration in place that's trying to redefine who can come in and essentially trying to slam the door again. And that's not working very well.
No. And in response to that, of course, another issue that I think is really pressing is what does it mean to stand up as an American? So you have Make America Great Again, this idea that for some it is to follow the leader of the country, perhaps somewhat blindly because they are the leader of the country. For others, it is to resist when they see something that doesn't seem to comport with the values of the country. So I think, for instance, of the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, and the ways in which this was an assertion of the value of each life within the United States, and the value that it should not be where you were born or where your great-great-great-grandparents were born or what their status was, enslaved or free, but rather where you are standing alongside the values of the country.
And when we look at that conflict and that sort of conflicting sort of opinions, I mean, you relate it back to patriotism. What does it mean to be an American? Who can be an American? But also to preparedness. So we have are in the midst of this campaign to sort of shut the doors, if you will, to round up immigrants, illegal immigrants, and we go into it totally unprepared. I mean, the ICE is not ready to do the job that it's set up to do. And so what we see are the kinds of things like Minneapolis that becomes a disaster because they're not prepared. It's not clear what they want to do, and it's not clear how they're going to accomplish it. So you go back to that concept we started with Nathan Hale of preparedness. Nathan wasn't prepared to be a spy. You know, patriotism, he was willing to give his life to his country. And so in this current sort of era, as we're dealing with these issues, what does it mean to be an American? And are you willing to give your life up for your country? And of course, that takes us to Vashon Island.
That's right. And so how does an abstract concept like patriotism and Nathan Hale apply to Vashon?
Well, I think, you know, you have to sort of broaden out that concept because, you know, we don't have a Vashon Nation. We don't have a Vashon County. We don't have a Vashon City. You know, so what are you loyal to?
I have the flag, though.
Yeah, there is a Vashon flag. Yeah, there have been several Vashon flags over the year. But at the same time, what I think it comes down to the same question we asked earlier. What does it mean to be an American? Well, what does it mean to be a Vashon Islander? You know, Nancy, I mean, you've been an Islander for 20 years now. I mean, what does it mean to you to be a Vashon Islander?
I think it's a really interesting question because I recognize that for some, the island is a place of tradition. It is a place where their great-grandparents lived, and they have a really serious stake in the identity of the place, and I respect that and I admire that. I hope that alongside that, there's room for newcomers. We are a nation of immigrants moving from place to place, and some of the wonderful work that happens on the island is done by people who moved here last year or 3 years ago. And so my hope is that there's always room for those new additions who are contributing, who are thinking about, again, the values of the place and trying to uphold those ideas of inclusion, of democracy, of having a voice.
Yeah, you know, there's a book written a few years back about intentional communities, you know, sort of nations being intentional communities. And I think that applies to Vashon Island. I mean, very few people end up on Vashon by mistake. it's an intentional move. And you know, Nancy, you mentioned the sort of the traditional families that are on the island. And there are some of those, but that's a smaller and smaller part of the community. The rest of the community are people who have chosen to move here for a variety of reasons, but who have chosen to make this their home. And so in that way, have an allegiance, if you will, or a patriotism to the island that begins to define what it means to be Vashon.
So with that, we can keep in mind about keeping Vashon weird. Thanks for joining us for this episode. Nancy, thanks. Nice to have you back again. Next time around, we look at Thomas Paine and the American Crisis. Mr. Paine will be with us. And that is episode 24. So we'll look forward to seeing you then. Next time. Thank you again for joining us. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250. At voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.